So hopefully you all stumbled across the chair as you came in through the door. And having picked yourself up, you noticed that there were some handouts sitting on the seat, and you've all got one, which means that I can test you on the lecture in a slight twist. You do need to pay attention to your handouts compared with what's going to appear on the screen before you, because there are some deliberate errors in the handouts, which I have placed there in order to keep you all awake. DJ already spotted the first one, so he gets a gold star. In fact, he spotted a deliberate mistake that was in the presentation, and I had to fix the presentation as well. But anyway, we're on to Queen Elizabeth I. I believe what we have seen so far is really a history of how Roman Catholicism entered the United Kingdom over the centuries. It was never a very peaceful alliance. There were a lot of troubles, but gradually Catholicism took hold in the United Kingdom. And then we came to the time of Henry VIII, and you have seen that although he was no particular friend of Reformation, really he had only one interest in life, and that was himself and the perpetuation of his dynasty. Nevertheless, the Lord used that that self-interest on his part in order to bring about a break from the church in Rome. And I think you probably will have worked through the six wives of Henry VIII. You all have their names and their fates down now quite nicely. You'll have understood how some of them, there's quite a bit of evidence, for example, that Anne Boleyn was a true believer and was essentially framed in order to get her out of the way so that Henry could move on to another wife with whom to have an heir to the throne. Some of them, like Catherine of Aragon, were very much entrenched in a Roman Catholic position. And so there was, even through the reign of Henry, there was sort of going backwards and forwards when he thought that the Pope might help, and then he thought that he wouldn't, and ultimately broke away. In the subsequent years, I think you have seen how Edward came to the throne very briefly as a Protestant monarch, and there was quite a significant reform under him, which was all reversed when Mary followed him and took the country back into a Roman Catholic position. And that's really where we pick up at towards the end of Mary's reign. Elizabeth, you may recall, was the daughter of Henry VIII and of Anne Boleyn. I think she was 2 years old. She was born on September the 7th, 1533. That's the first deliberate mistake in your handouts. And that's the one that BJ spotted, where your handouts say 1553, which would have made her very young when she became queen. 1533, she was born. Henry, so disappointed that he didn't have a son by Anne, didn't even attend her baptism, her christening, as it's called in the Anglican Church, which was not a very positive start to his career as a father. But he basically then had Anne swept off the scene when I think Elizabeth was 2 years old, and she played really no further part in the court or in the life of Henry for many, many years. She was brought up in a little weekend residence of the king, I imagine, Hatfield House, by governesses and tutors. One particular tutor that she had was a man called Roger Ascham. She studied Greek and Latin with him. She received, actually, a very profound education. She was, by all accounts, a very intelligent woman. She became fluent in six languages. Towards the end of Henry's reign, Catherine Parr took a very active interest in Elizabeth, did a lot to reconcile Elizabeth to both of his daughters, to Mary and to Elizabeth. because of the way Henry kept divorcing and beheading wives at an advanced pace, and having marriages annulled and so on and so forth, it came about that both Mary and Elizabeth lost their place as heirs to the throne. And I think it was largely because of Catherine Parr and the work that she did in reconciling Henry with them that they came back into favour, at least somewhat. Elizabeth was taught the art of public speaking. She was, note here, very important, raised in the Protestant faith. It was unusual to have that skill of being taught in public speaking if you were a woman. But it served her in very good stead because she would have the ability from that to address ministers in Parliament, to address troops, to address the common people. She was quite a star with the people of England, as we will shortly see. And she learned how to use words and to use public speaking to turn the tide of opinion in her favour. She was very effective at getting her own way, and not simply by pouting and thumping the table, but by some fairly advanced political skills. During the time that Edward was on the throne, of course, Elizabeth's position was very safe. But he wasn't on the throne very long. When he died, there was a kind of very confused succession plan in which I think Lady Jane Grey pretended to the throne for a period of all of 2 weeks. The people weren't too pleased with that idea, so she didn't last very long. And Mary Tudor and Elizabeth together, by popular demand, I think, rode into London, and Mary Tudor, as you have seen, came to the throne. Then there was this thing called Wyatt's Rebellion, which I'm not sure whether you've seen in previous weeks. You have. Basically, an abortive attempt to prevent Mary from marrying Philip of Spain, in which Elizabeth was suspected of having played a part and was therefore confined to the Tower of London for some 2 months. There were quite a few cries for her execution at that time, but the Tudor monarchy was so popular with the people, and there really wasn't any stomach for that execution, and so Elizabeth was saved and placed under house arrest, where this gentleman, Sir Henry Bedingfield, kept an eye on her for some period of time. Ultimately, Mary died, and the news was brought by a running servant to Elizabeth, who was apparently sitting under a tree reading from her Bible. And as she received the news, she quoted Psalm 118, "This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes." She ascended the throne almost immediately, November 1558, and her coronation followed within a couple of months, on the 15th of January 1559. There was apparently rejoicing in the streets at the time of her coronation. Mary had not really been a terribly popular monarch, to put it mildly. And people were very pleased that Elizabeth was taking her place. And Elizabeth was very good at the art of public relations. She does, or did, things in her day that really, I think, were only rediscovered fairly recently, like the walkabout among the people, where she would address the common people, where she would listen to them, where they would put on plays and sing songs, and she would really spend a lot of time with them, I think out of a genuine concern to relate to the people that she had been placed over. So very, very popular with many people. Not quite so popular in some quarters. This is John Knox's comment. It is more than a monster in nature that a woman should reign and bear empire over man. So, obviously not universally accepted or approved of. Elizabeth appointed her mother's chaplain, this man Matthew Parker, to be her Archbishop of Canterbury. I think the place was somewhat vacant. In fact, they had something of a job finding a willing volunteer to place the crown on Elizabeth's head at her coronation. A number of Catholic ministers would refuse to do so, and ultimately they found something of an unknown, I think, to do it. And having taken the throne, Elizabeth appointed this man who had been very close to Elizabeth and taken an interest in her during her upbringing, obviously had been close to the family. He became Archbishop of Canterbury. And she appointed Sir William Cecil, Secretary of State, to be one of her chief advisers. She was very good at picking the right people to advise her. That's always always the sign of a good leader. And she certainly was able to pick in a very astute manner. Right from the beginning of her reign, she made religion her number one priority. And I think in all that follows, we have to judge Elizabeth in her times. If you think of a nation that has swung backwards and forwards from the pre-Henry days when it was Roman Catholic, Henry breaks with the church in Rome, Edward takes the country further away, Mary swings the country right back again, now Elizabeth is taking it back into Protestantism, you can understand something of the religious turmoil that there had been in the land. And that explains, I think, a somewhat political path that Elizabeth plotted to get through that difficulty and stay on the throne and able to do the work that she did. So she wanted to create a Protestant church to take the country back that way from the Catholicism that Mary I had brought in. So during the first year of her reign, in 1559, she summoned the Parliament to consider the Reformation Bill, which would create the new church. And under that bill, communion was defined as consubstantial, which is more of a kind of Lutheran view of things, and not transubstantial, which, as you know, is the Roman Catholic view. This is, I think, the view that Christ is communicated along with the elements, rather than Christ being the elements, as it were, the elements being transferred into Christ, transferred into Christ, effectively. So that was a very different thing to maintain. There was a litany created for the church that included some abuse of the Pope. It's not likely to be very popular with some people of the day. Ministers were ordered not to wear the kind of priestly gowns and garments and vestments of the Catholic Church, and they were allowed, contrary to Roman Catholic teaching, they were allowed to marry. Images were banned from churches, and Elizabeth was confirmed as the supreme head of the Church of England. So that was the Reformation Bill and some of the key things that it contained in 1559 when Parliament was summoned to consider it. It didn't meet with universal approval, to put it mildly. In fact, there was massive resistance to it in the House of Lords. They were comprised of Catholic bishops, and there were also lay peers, lay members of the House of Lords, who voted against it. In doing so, they sort of butchered the text that had been presented to them, changed the litany to allow for transubstantial belief in the communion, in other words, back to a Roman Catholic view, refused to grant Elizabeth the title of supreme head of the church. And so that was a little bit of a blow for Elizabeth in her early attempts to bring about a Protestant church within England. What she did next, we know as the religious settlement of 1559. This, by the way, is the text of one of the acts. I think it's the Act of Uniformity. Parliament, having kicked out the Reformation Bill, Elizabeth basically recessed the Parliament during the Easter period. And when Parliament reconvened, two new bills were presented in the Houses. Is this language understandable? The Houses, there are two Houses in the British Parliament, the House of Commons, or Commoners, and the House of Lords. In those days, particularly the landed gentry and the bishops of the church. So those are the two Houses, and these two new bills were introduced there. The first of them, the Act of Supremacy. This established Elizabeth not as the supreme head of the Church of England, but rather as supreme governor. Just a little bit of semantics there, but it made it much easier to have a parliament that wasn't at all convinced that a woman could be head of the church approve a bill. It means she is the head, but it doesn't say she is, and so that's clearly a much better thing to do in political terms. So also this bill obviously confirmed the independence of the church from Rome, where the head of the church would be the Pope. Secondly, the Act of Uniformity, which set out the forms of worship for this new church. But it did so in much more cautious terms than had been the case for the Reformation Bill. It revoked harsh laws that had been instituted against Roman Catholics. It removed all of the language of papal abuse from the proposed litany. And it used a suitably vague form of words that allowed both Protestants and Catholics to interpret the teaching on the communion to their liking, whether it was consubstantial or transubstantial. Let's take a bit of a look at the Act of Supremacy and try and understand the effects that it had. The clergy were, first of all, required to take an oath of loyalty to the Queen as the supreme governor of the church. If they refused to do that, then they were basically looking for a new job very quickly. It turned out that many of the bishops were unwilling to conform to this policy that Elizabeth was introducing, and therefore they were actually removed from their place in the House of Lords. And Elizabeth replaced them with her own appointments, which increased, of course, her power. She introduced or appointed an entirely new Privy Council, which was one of the top governing bodies, removing many of the Catholic councillors who had been there and again replacing them with people of her choice. So the factionalism in the council and the conflicts at the court were greatly diminished because one party was suddenly largely taken out of the way. The Act of Uniformity really established, as I said, the forms of worship in this Elizabethan church. The prayer books that had been created under Edward VI were merged into one book, and the Act required that it be used in every church in the land. Church attendance was compulsory on Sunday and on holy days. failure to attend church on any of these occasions would result in a fine of 12 pennies, which doesn't sound like very much, but what was a decent year's wage? I think you would... £2, so 40 shillings. So this is 1/40th. This is about a week's pay, just over a week's pay. For not attending church. The money being collected in that way was given to the poor. As we've seen, the communion wording was vague so that both Protestants and Catholics could participate in the communion service. And contrary to what was in the Reformation Bill, ornaments and vestments and all of the religious garb of the priesthood was restored as they had been pre the reforms under Edward. So clearly trying to steer a middle path here. Here's the Book of Common Prayer, as it's called. What was the outcome of these two acts? Well, the Act of Supremacy went through the Parliament fairly quickly, not too difficult at all. But the Act of Uniformity had a much harder passage because there were still a large number present in the Parliament who were of Roman Catholic persuasion and were opposed to the bill. And in the end, it passed by 3 votes, by 21 votes to 18. And so the whole nation's religious practice was settled. Following on from getting those two bills passed, Elizabeth sat down with William Cecil, whose picture we saw a little bit a few slides back, and drafted some royal injunctions, which were kind of supplements to the settlement, and stressed the continuity with the Roman Catholic past. Ministers, for example, were ordered to wear the surplice. Wafers rather than ordinary bread was to be used at the communion service. So once again, very much a political course trying to steer a middle path. We need to note, though, that Mary came under a lot of pressure from the Protestant side of the country in later years to change this settlement and make it, I guess, more Protestant, more reformed. She refused to do that. And the settlement that took place in 1559 forms much of the basis of what is today's Anglican Church, or the Church of England, which over here, I guess, is the Episcopalian Church. Very much a compromise solution, but the result was that England was returned to the Protestant faith. All of the books and the services of worship were in the English language rather than in Latin. There was this new Book of Common Prayer adapted from those under Edward that was introduced and required to be used in all the churches. But the compromise here is that traces of Catholic worship were carefully preserved. That vague wording in the communion or the Eucharist, the use of candlesticks, crucifixes, and clerical robes, and so on. Like all good compromises, who ends up being happy? No one. So it's not hard, therefore, to predict what happened here. You have the Puritans very upset, wanting more reform, seeing this, I would think, as a significant step back from what had happened under Edward, although a step forward from what had happened under Mary. But at least they reached some kind of uneasy compromise, which Elizabeth maintained throughout her reign. But of course, the Roman Catholics were also very upset because they saw it as a huge step back over what had been taking place under Mary. And as we'll see, several attempts were launched to reverse the outcomes of what Elizabeth had been doing in her religious policy under the settlement. First of all, trouble hit Elizabeth from abroad in the shape of her Catholic cousin, Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, who was married, as it turns out, to Francis II, King of France. In 1559, when the settlement was being discussed and decided upon, and Elizabeth newly on the throne, Mary had the support of France and, as such, declared herself to be Queen of England. As you'll know, there's always been a kind of friendly rivalry between England and France. The irony here is that Elizabeth, I think, still maintained her right to be Queen of France, because historically France had been under the monarchy of England. So I guess this was one in the eye for Elizabeth, as far as that was concerned, but rather a dangerous threat. Mary came from a French family, I think, and her mother was Mary of Guise, who attempted to confirm the French influence and help things along by bringing French troops into Scotland to fortify it against any English aggression that might take place, which was again a slightly provocative act. In the end, a group of Scottish lords, I think, were not totally impressed by this behaviour. They were allied to Elizabeth. They acted to depose Mary Stuart's mother, Mary of Guise, and they drew up a treaty, the Treaty of Edinburgh, which sorted the whole thing out, much to Mary Stuart's disgust. But a lot of pressure was brought to bear on some representatives of Mary, and they signed the treaty accordingly. The French troops were withdrawn from Scotland, and although Mary vehemently refused to ratify the treaty, it did actually have the effect of dispelling that rather powerful French influence in Scotland and alleviating the problem as far as Elizabeth was concerned. When Francis II died, I don't think he'd been on the throne very long. I think he and Mary may have been married for some time before he came to the throne. He hadn't been on the throne very long when he died, and that left Mary in a bit of a conundrum as to what role she would play, because she was stuck out in France. So she decided to come back to Scotland as Queen of Scotland. She agreed in doing so that she would recognize the Protestant Church, but that she would continue to worship privately as a Roman Catholic. More trouble from abroad, still in the shape of Mary Stuart. She marries a character called Lord Darnley in 1565. Apparently not the most pleasant of characters, an arrogant bully with a drinking problem, and came to an unfortunate end when his residence in Edinburgh was blown into pieces while he was probably still inside, I suspect. And in somewhat suspicious circumstances, Mary Stuart, within a few short weeks, hooked up with this guy. Looks a bit like Johnny Depp, but I don't think it was. In fact, having said that, you'll see his name, Hepburn, and Audrey Hepburn and Catherine Hepburn are, in fact, descended from this character, who was described on the in the source that I consulted as the ruthless Earl of Bothwell. So Mary runs off very quickly after her husband here meets his end and marries this also rather dubious character. The net result being that there were rumours that Mary and the Earl of Bothwell had in fact been responsible for Darnley's murder. So at this point in time, the Scots had just about had enough. They'd been overrun by French. They'd had all this trouble with the Treaty of Edinburgh. They'd had Mary coming back and pronouncing herself queen, marrying this drunken bully character who gets blown up and then running off with the ancestor of film stars, of all things. That was enough for the Scots, and so they had her imprisoned at Lochleven Castle and forced her to abdicate from the throne. And her son, who was at the time much younger than he appears here, was crowned James VI of Scotland, later to be also James I of England. So that's trouble from Scotland, trouble from France, but there was also trouble domestically within England. There was the Northern Rebellion raised by Catholics in 1569, instigated by this character, Thomas Howard, 4th Duke of Norfolk, also Charles Neville, 6th Earl of Westmoreland, and Thomas Percy, 7th Earl of Northumberland. Just to make it simpler for us all, these people will either be called Neville, or he might be called Westmoreland. So you have to figure that one out. So, and the same Percy, Thomas Percy might be called Percy, or he might be called Northumberland. It was just to make life easier for folks in understanding who was being referred to at any given moment. But the uprising starts in the north, with these characters moving things along. The Pope, Pius V in Rome, decided to help things out a bit. So he issued a papal bull excommunicating Elizabeth and declaring her deposed from the throne, and that therefore those who had been her subjects didn't need to feel bound to be so any longer. Sadly, in an act of unfortunate timing, the bull arrived after the rebellion had been put down. So it was before the days of email, I guess. Elizabeth, I think, was somewhat shaken by all of this. She had been trying to do to unite the parties in the country, to bring a period of stability, and she is instead confronted with all of these issues. She reacted to this opposition by discontinuing her policy of religious toleration, at least to an extent. She started to persecute those who had become her enemies. That, of course, stirred up even more opposition and more conspiracies to remove her. But she decided that she would permit the Church of England from this time forward to take a much more decidedly Protestant line. And that expressed itself when Parliament passed a fairly reformed doctrinal statement of faith for the Church of England, which is known as the 39 Articles. It is still the doctrinal basis of the Church of England, although you may struggle to find any churches of England that actually appreciate that fact today. But we'll take a little look at the 39 Articles, because it's quite an interesting document. What these articles do is to repudiate the Catholic Church's teachings and practices in a number of areas. The supererogation of merit, the idea that you can do more above and beyond what is required of you and earn up sort of credits in the merit department that can then be dealt out to others who are not so righteous, I guess, and not so able to do more than is required. The 39 Articles very clearly teach against that concept, pointing out But the scriptures say that even when we have done everything that's required of us, we're still unprofitable servants. Teaching against the doctrine of transubstantiation, against the sacrifice of the Mass. These, by the way, are the article numbers that deal with these issues. Implicitly teaching against the sinlessness of Mary, probably by teaching the total depravity of all mankind, Christ Jesus excepted. In contrast, these articles affirm that Scripture is the final authority on salvation, and not what did the Roman Catholic Church teach was the final authority? The Church. Adam's fall compromised human free will. Justification is by faith in Christ. And both bread and wine should be served to all in the Lord's Supper. And ministers may marry. So really quite a significant fairly sound statement of faith taken altogether. On closer examination, it's clear that words were borrowed from Lutheran and more Calvinistic confessions, particularly in the areas of the Trinity, the Church, baptism, which is referred to as a sign of regeneration, the Lord's Supper, where it says the body of Christ is given, taken, and eaten in the supper only after an heavenly and spiritual manner, clearly teaching against transubstantiation. And the article on election and predestination uses very reformed terms in dealing with the idea of election to life, but somewhat like Lutheran confessions, doesn't deal with the doctrine of reprobation. There had been, however, this is the compromise piece, some radical reformers challenged certain of the articles that dealt with the propriety of creeds, the necessity of clerical ordination, the right of the sovereign, that's the queen or the monarch, to influence religion, and the right of private property. But in contrast to the desires of these radical reformers, all of those articles were retained. Also the legitimacy of official oaths. And the articles, not surprisingly perhaps, allow the monarch quite a lot of latitude for regulating the external life of the Church in England. So that was the 39 articles and a step by Elizabeth in response to the trouble that she had from abroad and the trouble that she was having at home. The result was, of course, more trouble from abroad. This time in the shape of Philip II, King of Spain. Your slide, in a deliberate error, may talk about the Armada. It isn't the Armada. That was a few years later, perhaps 1588, I think. So you may want to change the title there. Philip launched a surprise attack on Sir Francis Drake and John Hawkins. It wasn't a very friendly thing to have done. Elizabeth responded by agreeing that a Spanish treasure ship could be detained, and I imagine the treasure seized and used for purposes other than its original intent. Philip, in response to this provocation, really couldn't do very much. He was already engaged putting down a rebellion in the Netherlands. He didn't have the resources also to declare war on England, so he did nothing. more internal and external conspiracies. If you want intrigue, this is the time to have lived. Philip II continued to try and remove Elizabeth. He wasn't totally sold on the policy, but I guess he was dragged along into it, probably by virtue of his marriage. Thomas Howard, who we saw in that Northern Rebellion, was involved in the first of these plots, the Ridolfi plot in 1571. It was a big shock to Elizabeth that there had been a plot yet again to remove her from the throne. The Duke of Norfolk had been involved in the plot, and accordingly, since that was treason, he was executed for it. And the net result of all of this sort of bickering between England and Spain was that there were no longer cordial terms between England and Spain, and that's really what led up to, I guess, the Spanish Armada some years later on. So if we try and summarize all of this, what can we say? We could say that, as we've seen, Elizabeth became queen, 1558, very well-educated woman. She never married. In her own mind, she was already wed. I'm already bound unto a husband, which is the Kingdom of England. There are various men with whom she was close over the years, it's clear. She certainly used all of her attributes as a woman in order to secure her way. She was not averse to flirtation and various other devices in order to influence and procure what she wanted. But her 45-year reign is generally considered one of the most glorious in English history. If you think about what she did accomplish and all of the to-ing and fro-ing that had taken place and the instability during these early years that we've been looking at, to emerge from it with a secure and fairly well-established Protestant church was a significant achievement, one that you might regard as being almost impossible, humanly speaking, given the circumstances. The doctrines, and a fairly sound doctrinal statement was laid down in the 39 Articles. Those were more Protestant than they might have been if it hadn't been for the plots that had been launched against Elizabeth. But as we've seen, there were still elements of compromise within those articles. I think this is a very interesting quote from Elizabeth. She refused to make windows into men's souls. There is only one Jesus Christ, and all the rest is a dispute over trifles. And I think we might agree with the first statement, but I think we would probably disagree quite strongly with the second. But it does indicate her willingness to steer this middle path and to try to work towards compromise and to preserve an outward unity. Interesting legacy that she left to that church. I might say a word or two about that when we get to the end here. Most of her subjects accepted the compromise of the settlement in 1559, accepted the 39 Articles as their basis of faith. And it is thought that that settlement probably saved England from further religious turmoil and warfare, which certainly affected other European countries like France in later years. But of course, having embarked on this course, Elizabeth upset those who wanted a more thorough reform and faced seemingly endless plots from within and without to return the land to Roman Catholicism? Was it a job well done by Elizabeth? Was the Church of England reformed enough after all of this? Probably not. But one thing that it's always wise to do, looking back on these characters and these events, is to try not to pluck the characters out of their situations and bring them into the 21st century and condemn them because they don't behave up to our standards and our view of things. It's kind of difficult to project ourselves back into that situation with all the political turmoil and the plots and the threats, to understand how skillfully she managed to retain power, and that because she reigned for 45 years and established a Protestant church, that was really quite a remarkable outcome, and one in which she would probably trace the hand of the Lord. We may well go on to see there were further struggles in England, not least from the independents, the nonconformists who didn't like the Act of Uniformity, the Baptists amongst others, who actually were imprisoned, people like John Bunyan, really only won their freedom in about 1689. So there was a significant period of turmoil still to come. But one thing to comment on, this whole, as you look at the Church of England and how it was established, this whole idea of compromise and finding a middle road is one that still persists within the Church to a very great extent. The idea that we don't want to be too dogmatic, that there is a great pride in being a broad church and in being able to encompass people with all kinds of views. So that not so many years ago there was a Bishop of Durham who spoke of the resurrection as a conjuring trick with bones. This is a bishop in the church and accepted and tolerated in the church. Still, that is true. There is still a great deal of toleration within the Church of England. Still, it believes itself to be a very broad and prides itself on being a very broad church, still seeks compromise, still manages to find vague forms of words that make all the disparate parties somewhat content. How long that will continue, it's hard to predict. There was, during the time of Martin Lloyd-Jones, there was a very famous conference in which he appealed to the evangelicals within the Church of England to come out and to form a new evangelical church. I believe it was John Stott who intervened at the same conference and persuaded them all to remain in the Anglican Church and to work for reform from within. It's debatable what degree of success those efforts have met with. Some maintain that the breaking point of Anglican unity may come over the homosexual issue, the desire to ordain homosexual bishops, and that that is actually taking place in the American wing of the Anglican Church. Some believe that that part of the Church of England, the Anglican community, may well be put out if they persist. I remain to be convinced, based on the history of the church. I'll believe it when I see it, because over time the tendency is for those things to find acceptance when they really shouldn't. Anyway, that's a few personal observations. I don't profess by any means to be an expert in this era. I've had about one day to study it so far. But I'll try and answer any questions if you have them. Yes, Kathy.
How much did Elizabeth directly influence things like the 39 Articles and the Declaration?
How much did she directly influence the 39 articles and the settlement? I haven't seen anything definitive on that, but I would have to say that I think her hand was very much involved in directing the course of events. We saw that after the Reformation Bill failed, that the two new bills, the Act of Supremacy and the Act of Uniformity, came forward. And once those were passed, she, with Cecil, I think it was, sat down and drafted further injunctions. So she was very directly involved, at least to that extent. So I think having made it such a priority, and since it was probably the key issue to the stability of the nation, you know, she put her finger on it right from day one of her reign, more or less. This was the thing that needed to be resolved for the country to have stable government and, in her desire, a more Protestant form of worship. So I don't think she would have necessarily just left others to do that. I think she was very closely involved. That's the impression that I have anyway. Any other? Ty, did you have a question?
This is not on English Reformation, but I was kind of curious about the Stuarts. Were all the Stuarts Catholic, or were there any in Scotland that were Protestant of that line?
James the First, when he became King of England, was a Protestant monarch, at least. I don't know about others, but he certainly was. Yes. She grew old. She never married. The Parliament tried to make her marry or to appoint an heir. She refused to do either. Of all the people that looked likely to be the best candidates, they all had problems. Mary, Queen of Scots, was one of them. With obvious problems, although I think Elizabeth said provided she would marry somebody who was decidedly Protestant, she would be prepared to see that happen. But then Mary ran off with Darnley and things started exploding and it all got a bit embarrassing. It's not the kind of thing you want your monarchs to be doing. So she died of old age, ultimately. Any other questions? Yes. Ultimately, she was. What happened was that after all of that fun and games, she was, as we saw, forced to abdicate and kept at Lochleven Castle. She did then return to England, and I think she wanted to meet up with Elizabeth, but Elizabeth saw her as a huge threat to her own monarchy. So Elizabeth was faced with a few difficult choices at that time and ultimately had Mary imprisoned, I think, for something like 18 years. At the end of that time, Mary was actually caught in the midst of a plot to overthrow Elizabeth. And Elizabeth, very reluctantly, she could apparently be a woman, although she was of great intelligence, sometimes she was of equally great indecision. And she had Mary executed, apparently wept for a week after that, and it had a profound effect on her health. And so she was a very interesting woman, Elizabeth, but that's really what happened to Mary, Queen of Scots. Ron.
But it seems that the two great eras of English history have been touted as the Victorian era and the Elizabethan era. So is that reality? I mean, were the queen, were the women the ones in the era that brought them to their stature?
To say nothing of Margaret Thatcher. But, very good question. I think under under Victoria, there is no doubt that as a nation, that was the time of, those were the glory days for England, the empire. The sun never set on the British Empire. A huge power base. Right. Prince Albert, who was German, took a long time to become accepted, but was ultimately loved and did have a tremendous influence on things during that time. And again, there's no doubt that what Elizabeth was able to accomplish was a quite remarkable thing. How you account for that, I don't know. And I'm struggling to think whether there were any male monarchs who were deemed to have been equally... See Pam afterwards if you have any problems with that remark. Dick, I think you had a question.
I'm just curious, is the House of Lords comparable to our Senate or House of Representatives?
I can only tell you how it was when I left England. I know things have been changing a little bit, but it was entirely unelected in England. It's made up of people who are either lords because they own huge amounts of land, the landed gentry, as they are called, lords who are appointed. If they become too much of an embarrassment or they basically have fulfilled their purpose in the House of Commons, they get booted into the House of Lords where it's thought that they can do less harm. And they get sort of... they are not peers. They have a lifetime peerage that is not hereditary. It doesn't pass to their children. The landed gentry, it's a hereditary peerage. So there is succession through the male line. And the bishops of the Church of England, who are appointed by the Prime Minister, amongst others, and the Queen, I think, has a word to say. Those all take their seats in the House of Lords. So there are no elections, at least there were no elections. I think Tony Blair had some ideas to change all of that, and there have been some changes, but not probably as much as he wanted. So it's not the same. There are no elections to the House of Lords. It's House of Commons is about 650-ish. The House of Lords is less, I think. Maybe 200 or 300 is what's going through my mind. I'm not sure what's going through Pam's mind, but that's nothing new. Six? It keeps changing as they move the boundaries around and create new constituencies. But anyway, Kathy, you had another question.
Roman Catholics preach, practice their own religion at this time, or forbidden?
They were free to be part of the Church of England or pay 12 pennies a week for missing church. There was some persecution. I don't think it was anything like on the scale of Mary, and it seems only to have really begun in earnest after the first plots were launched against Elizabeth by some of the Catholic parties. But I haven't really gone into that in any more detail. Ty, you had a... Supreme Governor. Not really. I mean, it was felt that a woman could not be head of the church. And so there was a lot of opposition to giving Elizabeth that title in the Reformation Bill. And so they did what all politicians have endless skill in doing. They fudged. And they came up with a title, Supreme Governor, and apparently everybody was very happy with that because it didn't say head.
It
Yes, but practically it makes none. But I think, had Elizabeth not been a woman, there would not have been a problem in the title Supreme Head of the Church.
I agree with you there.
There would still have been the same problem for the Reformers, but they would have passed the Act of Supremacy under those terms, I'm fairly sure. Yeah. Okay. BJ, did you have a...
Oh, I was going to respond a little bit to what Kat said. I think the question was there much persecution of Catholics?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the only source that I read, which might have been just one of the history books, so I have, I'm certainly not a historian, but just as a comparison, there was some persecution of Catholics and some executions, but for example, the numbers are like this. Let's say it was 300 people that were persecuted. Elizabeth slain, she reigned for 45 years. The same number were persecuted. Protestants, of course, under Mary Tudor, who only reigned 5 years. So, in that sense, there was less persecution of Elizabeth in a considerable time. That's the general gist that I recall.
Yeah, she really wanted, I think, this outward uniformity. She wanted to steer the middle path. I think she wanted to try and keep everybody happy. The problem with the compromise is that you end up with nobody happy usually. Yes, Ron.
Did you run across information on how some of the Presbyterian reformers influenced some of these events?
Not really. There's really only, all you can hope to do in a lecture like this is to sort of touch the high notes, as it were. And if you read most of the biographies of Elizabeth on the web, they tend to be quite succinct and take the same path. There's a whole lot of detail that you could get down into. You could have a whole series of lectures, I'm sure, on the Elizabethan era. Well, there is some talk of getting into the Puritan era next year, which will be interesting. Any other questions I can fail to answer for you? Ty, yeah. They will. That was easy.